Welcome to the Sundance 2023 season of the Seventh Row Podcast. Sundance runs from January 19th to 29th, 2023. This is our second episode of the season and the first one to discuss films we've seen at this year's festival. I'm Alex Heaney, Editor-in-Chief of Seventh Row, and this is my 10th year covering Sundance in a row. I'm joined by Orla Smith, Executive Editor of Seventh Row, and this is her fourth consecutive year covering the festival.
Hello.
So Sundance marks the beginning of the new film year. It's a festival made up primarily of world premieres. In this podcast season, we'll be talking both about the films we see at the festival and how the films this year fit into the context of the history of the festival's programming. This is our second podcast season about a film festival. You can catch up with our Women at Cannes season from May 2022, where we focus more on the history of the Cannes Film Festival than we will on history in this season. And in that season, we talk about the festival, the Cannes Film Festival's track record for programming films directed by women. So today, on today's episode, we're going to be talking about the Sundance Film Festival's Spotlight program, which is Sundance's only program that is made up entirely of no world premieres. It's all films that have played at other festivals. Occasionally, there are ones that are like hits at other festivals or won awards. There's usually a couple of those. But often, it kind of like spotlights great films that maybe didn't get their due at other film festivals.
I think actually Sundance, in terms of like consistency of good programming rather than volume, because they usually only have about, you know, 5-6 spotlight films in the program, one of the best festivals at like curating from other festivals.
And for their audience, really, like, they do a good job of picking films that played at other festivals and maybe they weren't as good a fit at the other festival as they are at Sundance.
But unlike TIFF, instead of looking at the most popular places and just cribbing from them, I think they do a really good job of looking a little bit more carefully at the last year of festival programming and finding films that are really good but maybe slip through the cracks a little bit more and actually need the spotlight and deserve the spotlight.
It actually does what it claims to do.
Yes, and even if we don't always love every film in the spotlight section, there's usually at least one or two films that we really value.
And there's actually a lot. Like, I was making a list of the films that have played in Spotlight in the last 10 years, and a lot of those are films we have written books on, done podcasts on, or just really loved, or all of the above.
And you were talking earlier about how there are films that have played in Spotlight before, like The Assistant in 2020, where... like, both of us kind of had not been aware of that film at all before it premiered at Sundance.
Yeah, because it had a little blip of a premiere at Telluride.
Right,
didn't play any other fall festivals, I think. And nobody really talked about it then.
Yeah, and that's a film that I should have been aware of because I liked Kitty Green's previous film, Casting JonBenet. And
which you wrote about in our book on creative nonfiction.
Yes I did. Subjectiverealities.com. But The Assistant was her first fiction film, and it's really fantastic. But it was one of those films, like a film like First Cow, for example, where like if your film is not a big Oscar contender for that year, then no one will see it at Telluride and it will not get its due.
Especially when the distributor is planning on delaying its release anyway because they're too busy campaigning other films.
Yeah. And The Assistant, like, The Assistant's showing in the spotlight section at Sundance was basically its world premiere because it's not like many people had seen it before. Like, it kind of functioned that way from a PR perspective. So it kind of, it does sometimes give a chance to a film that kind of needs, like, a relaunch. And I'd say like two of the ones in this year's section that we really like, Other People's Children and The Eight Mountains, are films that didn't necessarily get totally ignored, but I think got bit overshadowed at their festivals. Like, The Eight Mountains did win an award at Cannes, but
people didn't really talk about it.
It was a bit of a quieter film. It premiered quite early in the festival, and it's definitely not as showy as some of the other Cannes films. In a way, Cannes wasn't necessarily like the perfect environment for it.
And in fact, one of the co-directors of the film, Felix van Groningen, has premiered a large majority of his features at Sundance. Which is, I guess, the other thing that the section sort of serves as is like a, as far as the fest, like the few times where the festival's kind of like using its clout to be able to put a film on its, like put its label on a film, is, you know, filmmakers who they have supported in the past, who premiered, who have now become bigger and premiered at other festivals. It gives them a home to go to if they want to play at Cannes. Not at Cannes. At Sundance.
And there's another, the other big film this year that we really love that is in spotlight is Other People's Children, which similarly, it was at Venice.
And TIFF.
Right, I mean, but it premiered at Venice.
Yeah, in competition.
And Venice is really, at the moment, kind of seen, unfortunately, as just an Oscar launch pad.
Become that.
And Other People's Children is a very quiet and contemplative film that also, like, it's a French film. It was never going to be an Oscar film because it also wasn't France's submission for the Oscars anyway.
Yeah.
So without that narrative, it died out, basically. Yeah. I mean, it was at TIFF. I think some people who saw it liked it a lot. We loved it, but it really did get kind of overshadowed in that, like, pool of films. And it really does need this kind of spotlight.
Yeah. And to my knowledge, it still doesn't have a distributor. I mean, I'm guessing if it's playing Sundance, there's a strong possibility it's picked up North American distribution and just hasn't, it hasn't been announced.
It does have UK distribution to be.
Oh, it does? Clear.
Yes, it's coming out here in April.
Oh, okay. Because in September, when it was at TIFF, it didn't have distribution anywhere.
Yeah. And that's also, Spotlight tends to sometimes show films that premiered at festivals the previous year but have a spring release, like last year After Yang and Happening were both films that were like, oh, we weren't doing the awards season last year but we did premiere amongst those films, so we kind of need a little bit of a boost before we get our actual release.
Well, Happening was France's submission for the Oscar won Venice, so it wasn't exactly an underdog film. It ended up in Spotlight, I think, because they were trying to spotlight abortion films.
Yes. I think After Yang is more apt to what I was describing.
Yeah.
Whereas Happening is kind of in the pool with the other film that year, Worst Person in the World. Both of those were kind of doing a bit of an Oscar-y push.
Well, and After Yang is also another prime example of a Sundance director coming home. Because that's Koganada, whose first feature, Columbus, premiered at Sundance. So then After Yang, which didn't get like a huge sort of response at Cannes when it premiered, it gave it, you know, another launch.
But yeah, that was a film that had sort of like a, I think maybe a February, March release by A24, and it got a little bit more of like, remember that this film exists at Spotlight.
One, I think my introduction to Spotlight when I first started paying attention was the second year that I went to Sundance, which was like when I was actually there in person, back when that was a thing, in 2015. And they were screening Girlhood, Celine Sciamma's film, which I was at the world premiere of that at Cannes. I got turned away from Mr. Turner and was like, you know what? I'm happy because now I get to go see the new Celine Sciamma. And
yeah, fuck you, Mike Lee.
We wrote a book about you, Mike Lee. It's fine. But then Girlhood played at TIFF and like nobody saw it there. And then it kind of like started to find its audience, I think, at Sundance. I mean, I don't know that that film ever really found its audience, but
I found a bit more of an audience there, certainly.
Yeah. And I met Celine Sciamma there and interviewed her about Girlhood at Sundance. That interview's in our book on Celine Sciamma. So I respected the festival for programming Celine Sciamma because I was already a big fan. And then I also found out that one of my favorite films, which was our number one film of the 2010s, Oslo, August 31st, was another film that was in the spotlight section. So back in 2015, I was like, Spotlight's pretty great, isn't it?
I think Spotlight genuinely has taste.
Yeah, it does genuinely have taste, which you can't always say about the other science programs. It varies.
One film really jumping out at me in this list is The Nightingale, which is another Sundance director coming home, like you said. Jennifer Kent,
right?
The Babadook, her first film, premiered at Sundance, and then her second film, The Nightingale, was in Spotlight. And again, that's another film that is really excellent, but really deserved a second. It went to Venice, and it had a really horrible premiere at Venice because it kind of got immediately caught up in these discussions about some guy at the screening sweared at Jennifer Kent when the movie ended and was screaming about how much he hated the movie, and then
there were walkouts in Australia screenings. Sorry, I didn't mean to.
But then at the premiere, I'm talking about the launch specifically. Yeah. If your film gets off to a bad start at its premiere festival, that can really screw it.
Yeah.
And that
see louder than
and
bombs.
Basically, all of the press afterwards was just talking about the controversy around the film and people being mad at the end of the screening. That's what people would ask Jennifer Kent about, and it suddenly became this controversial film where that was the only thing that was being discussed about it, and again, it didn't fit neatly into this awards conversation thing, and it's just kind of, I think people don't really know what to do with it.
Right.
I think a lot of these films, you could say people didn't really know what to do with it. And so having a little bit of a second love at Sundance is really helpful. Mm-hmm. And I think they pick good films to grant that to.
But another film that Spotlight did a good service to, which was You Were Never Really Here, which did play at Cannes, but it played on the very last day because they were the film was not done in the middle of the Cannes Film Festival. So they were finishing it, the night before?
Yeah. Yeah.
You can find out that whole crazy story in our ebook on You Were Never Really Here.
Oh, promo.
Well, I mean, this is kind of a credit, our view of the Spotlight Spotlight program is positive because we liked the films enough that we wrote books on them.
You Were Never Really Here technically wasn't finished when it screened.
That's true.
Cannes,
they
did
true.
Make some alterations to definitely the sound. I think it was mostly just the sound that they made alterations to. I don't know if they made alterations to the edit afterwards. But
it was a film that kind of got lost at Cannes because most people don't stick around for the last day. Most people by the Thursday or Friday, and so people didn't even see it at Cannes.
Which is what happened to the new Kelly Reichardt film.
Right.
Also, which should have been in Spotlight this year so that I could see it.
I know, right? What the hell?
She's a returning, Sundance person.
Yeah. Well, First Cow wasn't in Spotlight either, so.
I know. I'm disappointed.
If you're enjoying this episode on the Spotlight section at Sundance, you might also be interested in our episodes on many of the films that we actually mentioned in this episode. In our podcast archive, you'll find episodes on films that have screened in the Spotlight section, such as The Assistant, which we paired with Promising Young Women to talk about rape culture on screen, Joachim Trier's The Worst Person in the World, and Oslo, August 31st. Oslo is actually paired with Another Round. We also have talked about Jennifer Kent's The Nightingale, Julia DeCourneau's Raw, which we paired with Joachim Trier's Thelma, and Warwick Thornton's Sweet Country in an episode on Australian Westerns. All of our episodes that are more than 6 months old are only available to members. In addition, many of our new episodes are for members only. To listen to all of our episodes, become a member today. You'll get a discount in our shop to purchase our books on filmmakers like Celine Sciamma, Joachim Trier, and Lynn Ramsey, all of whom have screened films in the Sundance Spotlight section in the past. To become a member, go to 7th-row.com/join.
So just to state what is in the Spotlight section this year, there are five films. That can vary. Sometimes it's less, sometimes it's more. Usually it's a very small section. And there are, between us, we've seen 4 out of the 5 films. The one we haven't seen is the documentary Squaring the Circle. So you have seen Limoncita.
Yeah.
Which stars Penelope Cruz. Where did that premiere?
Venice. Yeah, one of the sidebars. It's a first feature.
Mm-hmm. And then I have seen Joyland, which won the Queer Palm at Cannes. And then we've both seen The 8 Mountains, which I said premiered at Cannes in competition. And
Joyland is the Oscar submission for that country, isn't it? It's shortlisted.
Yeah, Joyland is the Oscar submission for Pakistan, and it has been kind of gaining a bit more traction lately. And then The 8 Mountains premiered in competition at Cannes, and it won the jury prize. It tied.
With Io.
With Io? Yes.
Which also we podcasted on.
Yes. And the jury prize picked well this year.
They did. All the good films were in the jury prize. And
yeah. And then Other People's Children is, I think, our collective favorite of the Spotlight section. That premiered in competition at Venice. It's a Rebecca Zlotowski film. We really love her. And it stars Virginie Efira. And we did talk about that film a bunch in our episode on the full festival films.
Yeah.
So we won't linger on it too much, but we really, really love that film. And I'm so glad to see it in Spotlight because, like I said, it just absolutely fits that mold of a film that I felt really needed some love and didn't get it.
Yeah.
And partly, deserved it.
Yeah. And partly because I think one of the reasons it didn't get the love it deserved is it's directed by a woman. It's about a 40-year-old woman who is dealing with not being able to have children.
All the drama is internal
and you're trying to pitch this to male film critics. Good luck. I mean, it did well. It got pretty good reviews, but people didn't love it, and it didn't get it didn't get the attention it deserved, which is, I mean, that's kind of been true of all of Rebecca Zlotowski's films, which she's made other great films that got no attention. Mm.
And again, premiering against all these Oscar contenders just doesn't, it's not a good environment for a quiet, contemplative film like this.
Right. But you've seen, if you look at the history of Spotlight, they've programmed films that are similarly in categories like that, like The Perfect Candidate.
Which is a film almost nobody saw it.
Nobody saw it. TIFF. Yeah.
Yeah.
I feel like nobody saw it when it came out either. We're still banging the drum for it, but...
Well, I was at TIFF that year, and I went to see it, and I was so surprised by how good it was.
Yeah.
I was like, wait, this is great?
I know.
I liked your previous really film, good.
And I wasn't going to see this one, and you made me see it, and I was very glad you did.
And I told you to, but it felt like nobody else was watching it.
No.
I interviewed Haifa Mansour there, and
at TIFF.
And we were banging the drum for that film for a long time, and it took so long for it to come out in any capacity.
Another year, I think. But another film that was like that is Maggie's Plan, which is kind of, it's a rom-com. It was directed by Rebecca Miller, starred Greta Gerwig and Ethan Hawke. It's kind of in a way, it kind of feels like a Sundance film, but it premiered at TIFF. And it kind of got more or less forgotten about. Actually, another film is Their Finest. If you start Googling around to figure out what was in the Spotlight section, good luck, because I tried doing that before this episode and had to do 5 different searches to find films I knew had played there but weren't on the Wikipedia page or the initial Sundance announcement.
I think both Maggie's Plan and Their Finest are kind of films that were both kind of lost and also kind of misunderstood.
Yeah.
They were not widely seen.
Mm-hmm.
And then a lot of the people who were the most prominent voices who did see it were kind of dismissive of it.
Yeah.
And
they were kind of nice movies rather than awardsy movies in the way that we now define awardsy movies. Like, I don't, which doesn't mean that they weren't deserving of awards. They're both impeccably made, really well directed, well written, well acted. They're both really good films.
What's key is like Other People's Children, they are films where, like, the dramatic tension is derived from the internal choices mm-hmm. that the female protagonists make.
Yeah.
And their quiet deliberation.
Yeah.
And that's not necessarily something that always goes well over well or is understood on first wind when the only people who were seeing it is like a very narrow press cohort. Well, speaking of, just to like go over this year's films a little bit, I will say I think, again, of the four that we've seen, two really stand out. Mm-hmm. Again, I have seen Joyland. I saw it back in September, I think,
yeah,
at the London Film Festival. So it has the combined negative effect of me not having liked it a ton and also me having seen it a while ago and not remembering that much of it, of a film that I found not super memorable anyway.
Yeah, and I should say I haven't seen it on your advice.
I will say that it got, there were a lot of people at the screening that I was at that really liked this film and really responded to it. Yeah. And it seems like that has been the case for a bunch of people. So who knows? I'm sure it will have
an audience, even if that audience is not us.
And it's an Oscar contender. So I think it will probably be one of the most watched films out of this year's spotlight, probably.
Yeah.
But I found it to be fine. Found to be fine. And I'm not going to attempt to say very complicated things about it because I'm probably just going to forget what happened in the film. So what did you think of Lilliancita?
Yeah, Alex, I would.
She saw a bit more recently.
I would say it was also fine. It's a first feature. It's about a gender non-conforming kid who, I think it's a little bit vague about whether the kid is a trans boy or just gender non-conforming.
That's interesting because that's also like Joyland is a lot about sort of like a family dealing with its members not conforming to gender and sexual roles, and it has a transgender character in it.
Yeah, but it's set in 1970s Italy, which is super Catholic. Uh-huh. It is at least set in Rome, where, you know, stuff was happening, and people were maybe in theory a bit more open-minded.
Where stuff was happening.
Well, I mean, like, it's not like it's in some sheltered tiny Italian town where you know this girl, this kid is gonna get shunned. And it's more or less a story about, well, it's hard to say what it's about because it's a film that doesn't quite go anywhere, but it's kind of about the relationship between this prepubescent, like maybe 12 or 11 year old kid, and their relationship with their mom, Penelope, who's played by Penelope Cruz. And Penelope Cruz is in this abusive relationship with her husband. Like, there's a scene where the central kid sneaks into their parents' room at night and is lying underneath the bed and overhears the father trying to force Penelope Cruz to have sex with him, and he won't take no for an answer. And then this is all shot from underneath the bed from the kid's perspective, and the kid starts screaming, "She said no."
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The formal conceit of the film is that there are all of these big musical numbers that are kind of like fantasy sequences that seem to be somehow sort of initiated by the mother character. And some of them are more real than others. Like, the first one in the film is they're setting the table for dinner, and the Penelope Cruz puts on a record and they're all dancing to the record as they're, and like lip syncing to it, I think, as they're setting the dinner table and they're kind of like moving the plates on the beat. And you're like, oh, okay, so this movie is going to take me into this sort of warmer world than the kid is generally facing. And then there are a few other sequences that are like that. Some of them are a bit more out there where I wouldn't, like, I can believe that this happened while they were setting the dinner table and that the mother was making this mundane task more fun, and that maybe the director is showing how maybe this would have felt to the kid or to the whole family. And maybe it wasn't quite as spectacular in real life as this. But then there's also one where I think there's like a communion or something, and then they're at church, and then they're doing a number at church, and like the nuns are dancing, and it's in black and white, and yeah.
I wonder to what extent this film was programmed as a kind of double bill with Joyland, or like they were programmed together, because they both kind of like present a repressed society and like talk about gender nonconformity and how that's treated by the society and the ripple effects that has on various people in a family. And they also both have dance as a very key part of the story, the storytelling. So I think that's interesting. I mean, we've only seen one of them each, but your description sounds like they do pair together in an interesting way.
Yeah, it's interesting that you're talking about it as a comparison to Joyland, because I thought a lot about Girlhood and the sort of the musical number is an escape. I mean, in our ebook on Celine Sciamma, I wrote an essay about what I called them temporary utopias in an unjust world, and talked about the Diamonds number in that as being one of these temporary utopias. And something about L'Immensità reminded me a bit of Tomboy, a bit of Girlhood. And I wondered about the programming, too, as far as, like, you know, they programmed Girlhood in the past. Maybe they're looking for a similar sort of mix of realism and heightened realism in a film.
Mm-hmm. I think we'll leave other people's children for now. And just direct you to our our full film festivals episode, because we do talk about it in quite a significant way there.
Yeah.
And we'll just say that we really love it, and that we'll probably do a full episode on it at some point. But yeah, the Eight Mountains we haven't talked about yet, so we'll use this opportunity to do that. But Alex, you watched it a while ago, and you've been, you know, recommending it to me since, so I was excited to see it in the spotlight as a kind of excuse to watch it.
Yeah, I saw it at Cannes, and then I watched it again more recently to prepare for the podcast. I really liked it when I saw it at Cannes. It's kind of a very simple story. It's a film about these two boys who meet when they're, I don't know, 10 years old. One of them comes from a more privileged background. He lives in the city, and they go rent this summer place in the country where he meets his friend. He meets this kid, Bruno, who comes from a working class family that has been farming, or more specifically, like, doing cheese making in the area for generations and generations and generations. And they become friends over one summer, and then the film kind of follows them as they pick up and leave and pick up with their friendship over the next like 30 years. And you know, the way that their paths diverge, that the more privileged character is named Pietro, and as an adult he's played by Luca Marinelli, who was the star of Martin Eden. And I hated that movie so much that
he redeemed in your eyes.
Yeah, now. I feel like I hated Luca Marinelli, but it wasn't anything he did. It was just the movie I hated. I really loved him in this film. I thought it was great. Like, now I'm a big time fan. And his friend Bruno is played as an adult by Alessandro Borghi. And sort of the premise ends up being that, you know, Pietro sort of spends his adult life wandering the eight mountains of the world is something that they talk about in the film. And he's a writer, and he's not married, he doesn't have kids, he hasn't quite figured out who he wants to be. He was estranged from his father when he left home at 18, and he kind of like didn't keep in touch with his family.
And it should be said that the film is kind of told from his perspective,
yeah.
Voiceover wise, and also in the fact that he's a character we really see kind of outside of the context of the friendship.
Whereas we only see Bruno if Pietro is around. And Bruno, who's more working class, he ends up staying in the same place and, ends up living a sort of more traditional life. For better and for worse, because part of his problem is that he does not understand that there is a world elsewhere, and he kind of gets trapped into a certain lifestyle that he feels is his inheritance. But the world has changed. Mm.
But I mean, and it's also it's a bit more like complicated.
Yeah.
I think there are things about that life that he does really value, but there's also the fact that like that life is increasingly unsustainable due to a lack of government support,
yeah,
and the kind of the farming industry dying in general. And so even if that is a life that he chooses for himself rather than taking the opportunity to like that he gets at one point, there's a kind of crossroads moment where he has like potentially got a chance to go to school in the city,
mm-hmm.
and it doesn't end up
Pietro's
happening.
Parents are willing to pay for it and house him.
Yes. And it doesn't, and I think he's conflicted at the time, and then eventually his aunt that he tells him that he lives with, right? His aunt and his uncle.
Yeah, I think so. I think his dad says no to the school, or his uncle says
no. Yes, it's his dad. One of his guardians says no, and so despite him being conflicted to start with, the decision is kind of made for him. And you get a sense that, you know, he could be happy with this kind of life, but this kind of life isn't really possible anyway anymore. It's becoming increasingly less and less possible.
Yeah,
and you see that over the years becoming harder and harder.
Yeah, and that's in like the voiceover narrative from of Pietro, like when he's a kid, is he's like, why would you take Bruno into the city? That would ruin Bruno. Like, mm-hmm. Bruno belongs in this place, and why don't my parents understand that? But yeah, I mean, the film deals with mental health issues that end up arising because of these choices that Bruno has made in a world that can't really sustain them. And, you know, it's a film that, you know, it reminds me a bit of Naomi Kawase, because it's a film that's really interested in nature. There are these amazing sweeping landscapes of the place where Bruno lives and Pietro ends up building a summer house. And, you know, like almost every image you see on the screen is like a metaphor. Like, you see them walking along these paths and you see the paths diverging, and like there are so many ways that this film could have ended up really trite. But I think it's so earnest that it ends up being really, I find it really moving. And I think one of the things that I really love about it is the way that you feel. Like, it's 2.5 hours long, and it uses that runtime purposefully, because you feel time slipping away, but you also feel the sort of epic nature of their friendship that lasts decades and across continents, even though it is tied to this one specific place where they met as boys, where Pietro returns every summer to the house that he built on the plot of land that his father bought so that, like, he would return there and hang out with Bruno. And it's kind of, the editing is so delicate that you don't really spot, and it never tells you how much time has passed, but like there's a scene early in the film where like 10-year-old Pietro is storming off because he's angry that his parents have invited Bruno to come live with them for the year without having asked him. And he storms off upstairs to where his room is, and we cut to the next scene where now he's in bed, but now it's like 15-year-old Pietro. Mm. And like 5 years have suddenly passed, and now he's no longer like, they're still going to the same summer place that they rent every year, but now he and Bruno don't talk. And, you know, another cut happens like this, and suddenly 15 years have passed, and they're in their 30s. And I love the way the film sort of stretches and compresses time, and the way it shows this friendship that is so tied, that in some way is timeless, but is also so tied to this particular place. Like, they don't really keep in touch, and they don't really know how to talk to each other. And generally speaking, they don't really talk a lot, but they seem to communicate a lot, even though they don't speak much, which is probably why their friendship doesn't make sense elsewhere. And so, of course, you know, as a big Oslo August 31st fan and a film that also deals with male mental health and a male friendship, I thought about that film a lot, which is about two people who, like, talk through everything and fail to communicate. And in this film, it's sort of like two people who are, as Pietro describes them, silent men, but that somehow kind of seem to understand each other better than other people. And, it deals with, in some ways, it's a lot like Other People's Children in the way that it kind of deals with what is modern adulthood. Like, you're 40 and you don't have kids and you're not married and are you in a, and you don't have a stable job. And, well, she has a stable job in Other People's Children. But so, like, are you a grown up yet? And in Pietro's case, he's also a wanderer who's wandering the world and a writer. And he wonders about his choices, and Bruno has made the sort of more traditional choices, but, you know, he ends up not happy well, he's happy for a time until it's not sustainable. Whereas I think Pietro does kind of find happiness, and the way these two men whose paths have diverged still sort of find a meeting place, it's very touching. And the location where it's shot is just incredible. So the film gets a lot of mileage out of those sceneries, and you sort of, and like the feeling of like the vastness of nature and time passing and things staying the same, but people not staying the same, and people changing and not changing. I don't know. I find it a bit of a weepy, but in a good way. And the first time I saw it, I really liked it, but I felt like I hadn't sort of put my finger on it yet. Like, I felt like I needed to see it again to really get it, because I didn't really know where it was going. Like, you might think that it's going in a queer way, that they're gonna have some kind of romance, but it's a platonic friendship. And I don't know, seeing it again, I kind of felt like knowing where it was going, I could feel more what it was doing. And I think it's a really special film, but it is one of those films that's kind of like deceptively simple. I can see why it didn't necessarily go over well at Cannes. Like, not that it got bad reviews, just that it wasn't,
it's not flashy. So yeah, it's a kind of film that at Cannes could be well reviewed, but then by the end of the festival forgotten in favor of other things.
Yeah, it's not the kind of film people like to look at and call a masterpiece. I don't know, I hate that word. I don't want to identify it as one or not. I'm just saying that it's the kind of film people don't even want to touch that word for, because it's not like audacious in its visual style. It's very traditional.
But you're right that it's epic in scope.
It is
epic.
Way. Yeah,
it's like an emotional epic. It's worth so saying that the film is, it's by a Belgian directing duo.
Yeah.
Not Italian. And yes. and the more well known, and there are a couple in real life, but the more well known half is Felix van Groningen, who has made a number of films, and a number of films that are not my favorite.
I walked out of one of them that was at Sundance in the World Dramatic Competition.
The last film he made was Beautiful Boy, which was like pretty lackluster, I think. Like,
fine. This is a huge step up from there, which I've got to imagine is thanks to his co-director, Charlotte Vandermeer, who is like his Greta Gerwig to his Noah Baumbach, making his films better. Or good.
they've never, this is the first time they've co-directed. I believe this is her first film directed. But she has collaborated with him before in like a writing capacity. But yeah, this is the first one they've done together, and I think that it kind of proves that that's a thing that makes his work better, elevates it.
Yeah.
And I hope they continue to make their films together, or at least he continues to work with her, because I do think it is really thoughtful and patient in a way that was a bit of a surprise, given that, like, I think neither of us were, like, a huge fans of his work before.
Well, his films tend to be more, quite overwrought, so it feels really restrained by comparison. I mean, not just by comparison, but just generally, it's kind of a restrained film, even if it will have you reaching, I mean, for me anyway, it had me reaching for Kleenex. But I think it has two really fantastic performances at the center. Never heard of Alessandro Borghi, and I think he's really, really great in a role with very little dialogue that isn't the central figure, and he really gestures to a whole inner life that we never get to see outside of the context of Pietro. And I thought Luca...
And my impression from you is that this is kind of like... a bit of an antithesis to Martin Eden, in the sense that, like, Luca Marinelli, you've seen him there doing this, like, more of like a hyper-masculine type of thing, in a way that feels a bit oppressive. And here he is very kind of sweet and open and vulnerable.
Yeah. Well, and they, but like, it is an interesting film that's sort of about masculinity. I mean, I hate to say that. That's such a... thing to say, but like, they're not really conventional, like, in a way the two of them feel like conventionally masculine people, in the sense that they don't know how to talk about their feelings, really. But as you say, they're both vulnerable and kind of gentle souls and emotional, and I don't know, maybe it was the beard, but suddenly I was like, I get why Luca Marinelli, why people think he's so hot. And
there's a lot of beard action in this film, some very hefty beards.
And they have to play these characters over like 15 years and make us believe that, you know, they've changed and they haven't changed. Without a lot of dialogue, without even a lot of, like, we don't really see much of their lives when they aren't together, but they have to suggest all of the things that have happened off screen when they weren't together. Like, we see a little bit of what happens with Pietro, but it's really about sort of the way that the two of them come alive when they're in the same space together. And they could spend a year apart, and somehow that year doesn't have the same meaning as, you know, one night of wine and food together. So that's the end of this dispatch from the Sundance Film Festival on the Spotlight section. You can go back and listen to our earlier episode, which is a preview of the festival and films we're looking forward to, and a bit more about the programming at Sundance. On the website for that episode, you'll also find our Sundance bingo card, because boy are they predictable. And you can you know, it'll work for any year. You can go back and watch films from Sundance from any year, and you will probably be able to fill out this bingo card, at least from the last 10 years. And we'll be back again in the next few days to talk about more films that we've seen at the festival. So make sure you subscribe to the podcast on your favorite podcatcher so that you don't miss another episode. You can also get email alerts from us about new episodes. You don't want us to get lost in your podcast feed. To get our emails, you can go to email.seventh-row.com and sign up for our emails there. We'll put a link to that in the show notes. And you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at bwescineast, bwescineaste. Orla, where can people find you?
You can find me at orlamango on Twitter. You can find my writing on Seventh Row, my podcasting on Seventh Row. You can find me on Instagram at orla_p_smith. And that's about it.
And you can find both of us at Seventh Row, SEVENTHROW, on Twitter and Instagram, and of course on our website, seventh-row.com. You'll see in the top menu, we'll have a link to the everything about this season, Sundance 2023, but you could also go to 7th-row.com/Sundance to find the show notes, links to all the other episodes, and info about the season. Thanks for listening.